It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin could have more money at the end of its current two-year budget cycle than lawmakers expected. The state's nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau released new revenue projections forecasting a surplus that is $1.5 billion higher than what was built into the budget that passed last summer. The numbers are still just projections, but this comes as the current budget aimed to spend down some of the previous state surplus. We check in now on where the extra revenue is coming from and how state leaders diverge on how the money should be spent. Tyler Burns is a senior research associate at the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum, which has analyzed the state's past historic budget surpluses. Tyler, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
So when the state budget was passed for the 2025 to 2027 biennium, the state was expected to have some more revenue than expenses. Where was that surplus supposed to come from?
So with this new estimate, most of this new revenue is going to come from income taxes, specifically, you know, withholdings and estimated payments related to, you know, additional hiring, wage growth, and, you know, people realizing more capital gains. And so the state, you know, after this projection, looks like it's going to be in a much better fiscal position than it was, you know, back in July when they made those projections.
So a mix of tax collections, stock market performance, how dependable are these types of projections? How could tax revenues fluctuate over the next year and a half, for instance, to change the amount of money Wisconsin can expect to receive?
Yeah, that's a great question. How dependable are they? You know, I think you're projecting the future. It's difficult. You take a lot of economic data and you project it forward. You know, in this case, some of the risk comes from, you know, we could come in lower if stock prices start to fall, if hiring slows down, if wage growth slows down. But, you know, and another big risk that's out there is in the last budget, the state instituted a new fee on hospitals that helped pay for Medicaid. That may be, the federal government may decide that's not allowed. And so that's another risk that's out there that would be more on the expenditure side. And so, you know, they're solid projections. LFB does these every year, but again, they're trying to project the future. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so, you know, things could go the other way in the future.
Can you give us just a little bit of framework for timeline? I mean, this is a surplus projection of revenue, as you said, over the next year and a half. When does the state actually collect that revenue to then have it available to spend?
Yeah, so, you know, most revenue, when you look at your pay stub and you have the little chunk that goes to Wisconsin state withholding, every month the state withholds income. And then also people make estimated quarterly payments and that money goes in. And then, you know, there's a big bump at the end of the year at tax time when people are paying their final amounts. And so, you know, as these payments are made, we can kind of track how we're doing. And so, you know, this new projection was somewhat unexpected, but, you know, folks like us at Policy Forum, we see the updates that Department of Revenue puts out and says, hey, individual income is actually tracking quite a bit higher than was expected. It looks like there's going to be more revenue. And so, you know, over time, as those collections happen, you get more and more certain about what the final number is going to be. And so, you know, in the next 2 or 3 months, we're probably pretty close. A year and a half out, it becomes more difficult to project.
So how does this $2.5 billion surplus projection compare to what we've seen from other recent budgets in Wisconsin?
So we're still at, you know, if it wasn't for the $4 billion, $6 billion budget balances that we had in the 22, 23, 24 range, a $2 billion closing balance would be one of the biggest in the state's history. Now, it's important to note that while we do have this new revenue projected to come in, we're still spending more over this budget than we're bringing in. And so, you know, there's more revenue expected to come in, but the balance is still going down by about $2 billion over the course of the budget. And the intention was to spend down that balance because the state, you know, the legislators decided they didn't need to have $4 billion just sitting in the bank. But it's important to note that we still are going to spend more over the next 2 years than we will bring in. And that'll set us up for the following budget with a little bit of what's called a structural deficit. And so, you know, we're from a balance perspective, in pretty good shape. From a structural deficit perspective, not quite as good a shape.
Tyler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Tyler Burns is a senior research associate at Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's been with us to look at what's behind the projected surplus in the Wisconsin state budget. And now let's turn our attention to how this budget surplus could affect state lawmakers and the remainder of Governor Evers' term in office. Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker from Milwaukee. Mordecai, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for inviting me.
How significant is an extra $1.5 billion of surplus beyond the roughly $1 billion that state lawmakers were expecting to have?
Well, it's a ton of money, no matter how you look at it. I think the context, the political context, is incredibly important. And in my case, I'm so old that I was around in the state legislature three times when we debated what to do with surpluses. The first time happened when Governor Marty Schreiber was running for a full term, and Lee Dreyfus, the sort of no one who knew, was running against him as the Republican candidate. And there was a surplus, and Lee Dreyfus's campaign was, give it back. You overtax the people. It's their money. Give it back to them. And Lee Dreyfus won. And what happened, of course, the first day that he was governor, is he got the legislature to pass a refund to send out checks to the people to undo the surplus. Now, what's the rest of the story? It's just like all the fairy tales. Something bad happened. There was a recession. And all of a sudden, state government during Lee Dreyfus's time was in terrible shape financially. So Tony Earle runs for governor in 4 years later. By now it's 1982. And he said, I'm running to increase the sales tax by one penny for 1 year so that we can overcome the deficit. There was a huge deficit. So Tony Earle gets elected. And then what happens? He said, well, first it'll be a temporary 1%. And then he decided that it was necessary for it to be a permanent 1%. That's how we went from 4% to 5% in the sales tax. I was in the legislature voting on all these things. And what happens when Tommy Thompson runs against Tony Earle? He says, the sales tax is too high. Look at what Tony Earle did. Elect me governor. And believe it or not, there's one more half of the story. Tommy Thompson gets elected. There is another surplus. Tommy Thompson says, let's give back half of it and let's use the other half to strengthen state government. So I'm here to tell the tale of what Wisconsin is about to face for the next 2 years.
Well, thank you for that walk through budget history. To present day now, I mean, we've seen Democrats and Republicans clashing strongly over how the last budget surplus should be used. Will negotiations be easier this time and around after they just worked through it last summer?
You know, it's easy to forget that just 2 years ago, when Wisconsin had a surplus, 3 years ago, and Tony Evers was running for reelection, and he called the legislature into a special session to deal with the surplus. And the Republicans refused to meet in special session. They said, let's wait till after the election, and then we'll decide what to do. So there you had a situation of the Democrats essentially wanting to give the money back or do something with it, and Republicans just wanting to sit on it from a conservative point of view. And now I think what was so interesting was that the co-chairs of Joint Finance, Republicans, of course, said we've got to be cautious about this new surplus.
They used the word stability and restraint. Yes.
Excellent. I'm so glad you gave that quote. Because I was amazed the traditional Republican response would be just like Lee Dreyfus. We've overtaxed the citizens. It's their money. We've got to give it back. It's so significant to me that they didn't say that.
So Governor Evers calling for a $1.3 billion package aimed at lowering property taxes. Could this extra budget surplus make that plan more viable?
You know, I think it comes down to whether the two sides are willing to compromise. You know, Wisconsin politics in the last 20 years or so has converted the word compromise to something like sellout or traitor. I think it would be easy for the legislative leaders and the governor to split the difference and agree to a compromise. But I'm not sure that Republicans want to compromise. I'm not sure the Democrats want to compromise. which would then mean that the money is sitting in the bank and that the election for governor this November will be a referendum on what to do with the surplus. You would think that current elected officials would want to give at least some of it back so they could run for re-election and say, re-elect me, I gave you money. But apparently the standard dynamics of Wisconsin politics have really gotten weird lately.
How do you think this extra budget surplus will change how Governor Evers handles the remainder of his final term in office, his final days of public service?
Well, clearly, Governor Evers, based on the letter, the message that he sent yesterday, would like to spend it on programs. Mm-hmm. And this is what Republicans criticize as one-time spending, one-time money for permanent spending. He did not emphasize much doing more significantly using it for a property tax cut, although he included some of that in his message. I think the standard compromise would be 50-50. Spend half of it on returning it to the taxpayers, spend half of it on fully funding programs that are underfunded. You could agree to that in about 10 seconds, but Wisconsin politics, everybody has their heels dug in. Everybody's trying to show how tough they are. Everybody's hoping that their side will win in the November elections. So I'm not sure. I think we might be in a kind of a paralyzed situation.
How careful do lawmakers need to be with surplus projections very quickly? Because you told us a historical tale to be cautious.
There's no doubt about it. Think of the macro economy. Let's say President Trump gets a majority on the Federal Reserve. Let's say the new Federal Reserve cuts interest rates by 2 full percentages. All of a sudden, the stock market takes off, construction takes off, but people's paychecks don't take off. Then all of a sudden, we've got inflation. And so it's just so variable. And I think that most Wisconsinites would agree about the importance of being fiscally conservative without overdoing it.
Mordecai, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker from Milwaukee, with us to discuss the political ramifications of the projected state budget surplus. Earlier, we heard from Wisconsin Policy Forum's Tyler Burns. Coming up, a look at President Trump's approval rating in his first year back in office. Check in with Marquette University pollster Charles Franklin, who says there were some modest up periods in early summer, but
it's been generally a steady downturn. And at least so far into January, we're not seeing anything other than a flattening out.
That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today marks 1 year since President Trump was sworn in for his second term. And this week, WPR is taking a look at how the administration's policies have reshaped Wisconsin 1 year in. His first day back in the Oval Office, Trump signed a slew of immigration-related executive actions. The crackdown has continued from there with massive enforcement operations in cities across the country and immigration detentions hitting record highs. And as Bridget Bowden reports, immigrants in Wisconsin say they're feeling more afraid than ever.
Soledad Alvarez works a few times a week at the community space in Whitewater, a sprawling warehouse that's part food bank, part community center.
¿De dónde son?
Yo soy nicaragüense.
Mucho gusto.
As people line up to get food, clothes, and household items, Alvarez asks if she can help them with medical appointments or other healthcare needs.
Y yo soy promotora de salud y estoy aquí.
The community space was seeing a growing number of immigrant families since it opened 6 years ago. But in the last year, there's been a noticeable drop.
Tenían miedo de venir a agarrar su comida porque ellos pensaban que podía entrar a ICE aquí.
They're scared to come and get food, says Alvarez, because they're afraid they might run into immigration and customs enforcement. During the last year, the Trump administration has sent large ICE deployments into cities like Chicago and Minneapolis. In the first 10 months of 2025, ICE arrested nearly 1,000 people in Wisconsin, an almost 25% increase from all of 2024. It's been a year of uncertainty, says Juan Sandoval, who is picking out clothes at the community space.
En este último año, todo cambió, radicalmente todo cambió. Todo.
Sandoval came to the U.S. from Nicaragua in 2021. But he says everything has changed in the last year. Now, other than work and basic necessities, his family doesn't leave the house much. He says it's making his kids depressed, and that's hard.
Es difícil estar así.
Whitewater was adjusting to an increased population of immigrants even before Trump began his second term. In late 2023, the police chief sent a letter to President Joe Biden and others pleading for assistance in response to a rapid increase in immigrants arriving to the city. The letter attracted attention from some politicians who said it proved that the U.S. immigration system was broken, and it was even cited in a Trump executive order. It was a difficult time for the immigrant community, says advocate Jorge Islas Martinez. But since then, he says communication with the local police has improved.
If that the Whitewater Police Department is here to protect our community, not to divide the community.
But he says that progress has now been overshadowed by the fear created by Trump's immigration crackdown. He's especially concerned that immigrants are being portrayed as criminals.
Which I don't think is right, because most of us would like to study, to learn English, to work overtime.
According to data from the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, more than 70% of people currently held in ICE detention have no criminal conviction. Islas Martinez says advocates do their best to help people manage their fear by picking up groceries, taking kids to school, and bringing people to the community space.
We go day by day, and the situation is getting worse and worse. And unfortunately, we're just waiting for the worst.
Immigrant advocates have called for an end to the federal 287G program, which allows local law enforcement agencies to partner with ICE in various ways. They argue it creates a pipeline from contact with local law enforcement to deportation. The Kewaunee County Sheriff's Department signed on to that program last year. Sheriff Matt Josky says he believes it allows the department to maintain their pre-existing relationship with ICE.
It is nothing more than the enforcement of the law.
While Trump's crackdown differs from past administrations' approaches, he believes federal immigration authorities are largely targeting criminals. Still, Josky says laws could be changed to better support law-abiding immigrants living and working in the state.
I hope that at some point, some legislator somewhere can get together with a group and say, let's look at some comprehensive immigration reform where we can treat the families, these people that are working hard, trying to make a life here. We got to be able to treat them differently than we would gangs and violent criminals.
But in the near term, there's likely more enforcement to come. ICE and Border Patrol are set to receive an additional $170 billion between now and 2029. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And tomorrow, we'll have a story on the impact of cuts to the federal workforce here in Wisconsin. In 2024, President Trump won Wisconsin by less than one percentage point. His second term in office has been polarizing, with his administration's aggressive actions on everything from immigration agents flooding into major cities to claiming control of Venezuela. Two Wisconsinites who voted for Trump rated his first year back in office for us. Dylan Liptak is a recent graduate of St. Norbert College. He was the head of the college Republicans and overall gives Trump a B grade. Although he has concerns about tariffs, Liptak likes the president's moves on immigration and the economy.
I was a big fan of the Big Beautiful Bill when it came out. Actually, my work named one of our specials after it. We call it the Big Beautiful Burger. And I liked a lot what it did there, too. Just reducing taxes, extending those 2017 tax cuts, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, which I think people in my industry would be happy to hear. And the various other energy-related executive orders and policies in that bill that helped cut the cost of energy.
We also checked in with Charlene Abugrin, a Milwaukee entrepreneur who gives Trump a B-plus for his first year. She appreciates the tariffs the administration put in place and the president's efforts to bring jobs back to this country and boost employment for Black Americans. But she cautions that change won't happen overnight.
So we have to remember that all those policies that were in place by the Biden administration are still there. And even though Trump made great changes, we still have remnants of the prior administration.
Voters across the country will have their next chance to weigh in on the Trump presidency in November's midterm election. To understand how Wisconsin voters are feeling about the direction the country is moving, we turn to Wisconsin's preeminent pollster, Charles Franklin. Franklin is the director of the Marquette Law School poll and professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. Charles, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What do you notice about approval ratings for President Trump after 1 year in office?
I think there are two things to really point out. One is, over the course of his first year, his job approval numbers have moved steadily, but I would say slowly down, going from about 48% approval down to about 41 or 42% approval now. You will see headlines that say his approval has plummeted. I don't think that's a good adjective. Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen is a pretty steady erosion of his support. And right now in our state polling, he's about 14 points more disapproval than approval. That puts him about where he was at this time in his first term, though in the national polling, he's running just a little below where he was at this point in the first term.
Oh, that's interesting, about where he was at this point during his first term, because this has been, by all accounts, his first year, you know, some dramatic changes that have come to America and certainly to how our country, you know, operates around the world.
It certainly has been, and it's, you know, people call it a fire hose of new things coming out. I think that understates the case. It's really been a deluge. But what we saw in the first term is that he fell off in the summer and the fall, and then got a little bit of recovery in the December-January period. What we're seeing right now in the second term is there were some modest up periods in the early summer, but it's been generally a steady downturn. And at least so far into January, we're not seeing much, if any, evidence of anything other than a flattening out. It doesn't look like he's dropped further in December and January, but he also hasn't recovered much in that period. The other thing that's a big part of this is the deep partisan polarization, because even as the public overall is giving him approval ratings in the low 40s, Republicans continue to give him an approval rating of 85 to 88%. And that supports him with his base quite solidly. Those folks have not moved away from him over the course of the year. At most, their approval has come down from about 92% to that 85 to 88% that we're seeing now. But he's substantially underwater with independents and, not surprisingly, very underwater with Democrats.
We have seen the protests that have occurred, you know, nationwide here in Wisconsin following the fatal shooting of Renee Good by an ICE agent in Minneapolis. Do these events impact Trump's approval rating?
Yes, they do, but they're not the overwhelming force that you might expect them to be. Again, part of this is polarization, because in the early polling after the Renee Good shooting, we saw solid majorities of Republicans approving of the ICE agents' actions or saying they were justified, while majorities of independents and huge majorities of Democrats don't think that shooting was justified. There's also division on the handling of deportations and immigration issues generally. When we look at how Trump has handled border security, he gets one of his highest ratings. 54% approve of what he's done on the southern border. But on immigration overall, that falls to 45% approval. And when we ask about how ICE is handling its job and handling enforcement around the country, approval of that's even a bit lower. And so there's a range here, even within the topic of immigration, where border security is still the president's strong suit, but deportations less so and ICE even less so.
I want to turn our spotlight now to economic issues that were seen as President Trump's biggest strength during his 2024 campaign. How do Wisconsinites feel now about his handling of the economy?
Well, this has turned into a weakness for him. In our recent polling, his rating on the economy overall is about 7 points lower in approval than his overall approval rating. And his handling of inflation is even lower. So overall, we had him at 43% approve, but the economy at just 36, and inflation all the way down into the 20s at 28%. So those things that were big issues and big problems for Joe Biden in his last year, those issues are now Trump's weak spots as well.
The kitchen table issues like family finances and cost of living pressures.
Absolutely. And when you think about what he's been successful on, the border in particular, that issue where people give him credit and approve of what he's doing, now only 10% say that's the most important problem to them. Mm. It was higher during the Biden administration during the 24 campaign. Whereas 56% cite inflation or the economy as the most important issue. So you're looking at almost six times as many people saying the economy, those kitchen table issues, are top of their minds, most important issues. And the one that President gets success, you know, gets approval on, immigration, is no longer near the top of that list.
President Trump ran on this America First policy agenda and criticizing getting involved in foreign countries and entanglements abroad. And now we've seen he's asserted the U.S. capturing Venezuelan leader Maduro, bombing Iran's nuclear sites in June, now threatening to seize Greenland. How do voters feel about U.S. intervention outside our borders?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed picture, I'd say. People have, in general, opposed these sorts of international events before they happen. So when we asked in November about using military force to remove Maduro from Venezuela, only 25% were in favor of that. After it happened, in other polling, not mine yet, but other polling found about 40% in favor. So that was a significant increase in support. However, 42% disapproved of the president's actions in Venezuela. We'll see how this develops as the situation settles down over time. But at least the immediate reaction was an increase in support for the action, but a relatively even balance, 40 in favor, 42 opposed, a pretty even split on whether it was a good idea or not. On Greenland, we've seen big majorities opposed to that. We asked about it last year when he first brought it up. Recent polling in just the last couple of days has shown, again, large majorities opposed to acquiring Greenland and especially opposed to using military force to take Greenland, something that the White House has raised as a real possibility.
The Constitution, of course, barring President Trump from a third term, what do approval ratings mean for his remaining time in office?
They, in principle, mean a lot for Congress and how willing Congress is to go along with the president on any set of issues. Now, we've seen the Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate very largely support the president over the past year. It's sort of news that in the last few weeks, we've seen Congress push back on a few things. One was on forcing the release of the Epstein files. That was sort of the first one of these. But we've also seen them push back in the Senate, considering disapproval of the Venezuela incursion. And we saw the House just this last week vote to extend tax credits for the Affordable Care Act to cover insurance premiums for people, including in those votes, anywhere from 16 to 24, or I think in one case over 30 Republicans voting against the president. Now, that is hardly a turning away from the president, but it is more pushback than we saw over the previous 11 months of his second term. And I think these difficulties he's having on with the public, especially on economic issues, are reasons why members of Congress, if his own party, are now finding it important for them to take the other side on things like the insurance premiums for the Affordable Care Act.
So, Charles Franklin, the road to the midterm elections is underway to November. What will your polling look like in the months ahead?
Well, one thing we're already looking at is whether people think they'll vote for the Democrat or the Republican candidate for in their congressional elections. Democrats have a small advantage in that, 3 to 5 points. Upcoming, we'll be asking about which party do you think would do a better job of handling these issues, from foreign policy to the economy to health care? Because in some sense, the congressional elections are about which parties do you trust rather than do you trust the president or not. We'll certainly continue to monitor President Trump's job approval on a host of issues and asking what issues are most important to the public.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for your analysis. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That is Charles Franklin, the director of the Marquette Law School poll and professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. We've been looking back at President Trump's first year back in office and how his policies are affecting polls and his favorability rating. And as we look back this week, you can share your reflections on President Trump's first 12 months and assign a letter grade to year one of his second term. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, people around the world dial back on drinking during dry January. Visit a Milwaukee lounge that gives non-alcoholic cocktails top billing alongside their versions that include alcohol.
It's a celebration of fine drinking, and that extends into the alcoholic space, that extends beyond the alcoholic space. Every concoction that we can put into a glass that we think you will love and enjoy.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. People in Wisconsin and around the world are in the midst of observing Dry January, a popular trend of giving up alcohol for the first month of the new year. And bars and restaurants around the state want to make sure their customers still have something special to drink that isn't just club soda. So enter the world of non-alcoholic beers, wines, and cocktails. The market for these drinks, often called NA, zero proof, or spirit-free, has been steadily growing over the past decade. And few people are more committed to NA mixology than Ryan Castellaz, who co-founded the bar Agency in Milwaukee in 2024. It's a cocktail lounge where any of the drinks can be made with or without alcohol, and it was nominated last year for a James Beard Award for Best New Bar. He talked with Rob Ferret.
I want to hear some of the origin story for Agency, especially the idea that, hey, the non-spirit cocktails get equal billing with the ones with alcohol in them. What led up to that for you?
Yes, sir. So like most beautiful things in the world, you know, Agency was kind of born as a product of necessity. We originally had a coffee shop, which we still have in Milwaukee, called Discourse, and it had a location in Crossroads Collective. And Crossroads Collective was designed to be an incubator for new ideas and new concepts. And so we ideated the only concept that we could do in this space, which I can't cook, and Crossroads already had an alcoholic cocktail bar. We ideated a totally non-alcoholic cocktail bar called The Counter. And in doing The Counter, we learned a lot. One, we learned that we are deeply passionate about the NA segment, and we're deeply passionate about returning Agency to the modern drinker. And the second thing we learned is that a fully non-alcoholic cocktail bar, at least in the state of Wisconsin in 2024, was not a sustainable venture. And so we went back to the drawing board to decide, how do we do this? How do we achieve the mission of serving those who have decided to remove themselves from the indulgence in alcohol, whether it be for a night, a week, a month, a lifetime. But how do we serve this audience while also creating a sustainable business? And what we came to was this idea of the hybrid cocktail lounge. And the thesis of the hybrid cocktail lounge is that the agency, the full choice of the experience, lies in the hands of the drinker. And so at agency, each one of our cocktails is available alcoholic and non-alcoholic. And in a world where purveyors were being extremely loud about the fact that they were NA, we were taking the opposite approach. We were being very soft. We were trying to add nuance and subtlety to the process of deciding to make an NA decision. And so each and every cocktail on our menu is available both ways. And you signal to the server which cocktail you would like, the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic, through the use of a two-sided coaster. The black side is alcoholic and the gold side is non-alcoholic. And in doing this, we created what is truly one of the first in the country to provide a fully hybrid experience where every guest is able to have the exact same lived experience in our lounge, just without the presence of ethanol.
Now, you mentioned that the demand wasn't there for just non-alcoholic cocktails. How much interest is there, though, now that you've got this hybrid operation, how much are people in the non-alcoholic versions of the drinks you provide?
I'd say our current business is around 20% non-alcoholic. But this is really a scaling market space. We've seen market growth since we opened in our new space in September of 2024. It's been really, 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 really cool to see the trajectory, kind of curve upwards. And while our percentage is about 20% right now, we're seeing market growth in the non-alcoholic industry. And when you look at sales figures over the next, 3 to 5 years, this last year, alcohol shaved about $8 billion in market value. And as we look over the next 3 to 5 years, we're looking at an almost 10x reduction in predicted alcohol consumption. The generation beyond mine, I'm a millennial, the generation beyond mine is drinking much less. And the generation beyond there is even less so. So within 10 to 15 years, I predict a 50-50 or even greater skew of alcoholic versus non-alcoholic versus alcoholic drinkers.
Well, talking to our listeners over the years, Ryan, a very common problem I hear is from that person who doesn't want to drink ever or tonight, but so many social experiences rotate around drinking and not having, you don't want to be the one, as you mentioned, sitting there drinking a glass of water while everybody else has these cool looking cocktails. Do you get the sense
or
that you have kind
milk,
of
the classic?
Oh, God. Yeah. Do you have like mixed parties like that? Do you think where that one person who might not have felt like they were fitting in now has that option?
The majority is mixed parties. We will absolutely get people who come in, who everybody in the party is non-alcoholic. But that is not the majority. The majority is, we have a group of four people and say one person usually drinks, right? But they're pregnant or they're doing Dry January or they have a certain religious practice that prohibits them from the consumption of alcohol. But they want to go out there with their friends who don't share that same religious practice. Right. So that is actually a kind of the core demographic that we see in the bar is people who, for one reason or another, have had to refrain from the consumption of alcohol. And there are 100% also people who have just made the choice to pursue sobriety. That is becoming a much more popular choice. And as that becomes a more popular choice, we're seeing a greater influx of guests who have made that decision. But many of our guests who are exercising this option are guests who maybe normally would have drank, but for some extenuating circumstance cannot.
What goes into designing drinks, right, that are, unique kind of signature cocktails in the first place, but also work as non-alcoholic? It sounds like a challenge to me.
It is. It is a challenge. If it wasn't a challenge, I think more people would do it more frequently. And really what it is this. When a lot of people start, right, I think there is an understanding or a hope, a feeling that it may just be, okay, if I'm making a margarita and I have 2 ounces of my tequila, I'm just going to replace it with 2 ounces of non-alcoholic tequila. And while the industry is making amazing strides in terms of capacity and capability from alcohol to non-alcoholic analogs like tequila, gin, whiskey, we aren't there yet. There's a lot of organoleptic characteristics of ethanol that are quite hard to emulate. Things like mouthfeel, piquancy, dryness, burn, but all of these are things that ethanol adds to the cocktail experience that in great non-alcoholic cocktail making have to be recreated. And so for us, our process is we'll usually start as close to an analog as we can. And then from there, we identify the missing pieces, right? If we do an analog 2 ounces tequila, 2 ounces non-alcoholic tequila, and we taste, well, that non-alcoholic spirit is probably preserved with a little bit of citric acid. And so there is a higher acidity in that non-alcoholic cocktail than there is in the alcoholic substitute. And so we might drop our overall acidity down or raise our sweetness just a little bit. We might add a little bit more acid based on how that spirit is presenting in the cocktail. Right? So the first thing is we're balancing profile. That's probably the easiest to balance and to match. The second is to balance some of the more ethereal elements of the cocktail experience. And those include things like mouthfeel. How rich does it feel on the tongue, or how thin and how silky? And that we use things like sushi rice, water dilution to kind of recreate the mouthfeel of an alcoholic cocktail. Piquancy, you know, so that little tartness, that little bite that you get from alcohol that we can recreate using things like gingerol, capsaicin, vinegar. And then, of course, linger. So the lasting effect of alcohol, that ethanol really carries things on our palate far past the last moment of sipping. And so for that, we can use things that extend the palate or that dive into the far palate, things like Sichuan, tartaric acid, wine tannin, ingredients that really extend the length and effect of the sip. So it's kind of a multi-step process, you know, and the first is mirroring the profile, but the second is mirroring all of the other ethereal capacities that ethanol brings to a traditional alcoholic cocktail.
We're talking about Dry January and the art of making non-alcoholic cocktails with Ryan Castellez with Agency, a hybrid cocktail lounge in Milwaukee. I'm going to ask for some advice in a bit. But before I do that, a couple of things I wanted to ask about. One, do you get people maybe in the same visit having an alcohol drink for round one and being like, I'm good, but I want more yummy stuff, having the non-alcoholic drink for round two?
We do, though I will say less than I would like. You know, I think we are still kind of in a culture, for whatever it's worth, right, that those who are who can consume alcohol and those who make the choice to consume alcohol still have a little bit of a stigma against the consumption of non-alcoholic cocktails. And I think a big part of that is the incredible amount of mid non-alcoholic cocktails on the market, right? So they've had some sort of experience with a non-alcoholic cocktail in the past that has not lived up to expectation, that has felt like a misuse of funds. And so they are unlikely to give it a try, even in a place that specializes in it. You know, so I think right now we are in a state where people need to have and gather a bank of more positive experiences with the NA space for them to switch over to NA after the consumption of alcohol. Now, we do have the occasional guest who does make that switch, but it isn't as frequent as I would like. And it's something that we are working towards every day, trying to figure out ways to better communicate what we do in hopes that we can get more conversion clients who are making that switch, having that second drink, and realizing that it's every bit as good and honestly, sometimes, my friend, better than its alcoholic counterpart.
And you also, you telegraphed my next question. You used the word stigma, and I think people feel a little weird. I'm at a bar, but I'm getting something non-alcoholic, and maybe people are a little judgy. You're at a bar, and you're getting something non-alcoholic. Part of your mission, it seems to me, is, hey, we're here, we're socializing, we have beverages.
100%. One of the most interesting things that I've ever heard from a drink maker was a drink maker out of Minneapolis, and he was being interviewed for Imbibe, and the interviewer asked him, what's the weirdest thing you've ever made? And his response was, well, I mix poison every day, so I guess that's pretty weird. and this is a famous bartender, right? Alcohol, literally at its core, is a poison to our bodies. What I drink, I'm not saying I'm above it, but it is, you know, a thing that is not wonderful, right? So the fact that we've created, you know, an entire world based around this thing is the product of incredible marketing for, you know, 100 years. And so for us, the cocktail lounge is a drinking space, right? And it's a celebration of fine drinking. And that extends into the alcoholic space, that extends beyond the alcoholic space. It extends to every concoction that we can put into a glass that we think you will love and enjoy. And so a huge part of what we do, right, is to fight against words like the word mocktail. Mocktail is my least favorite word in the English language. Nobody wants to have a mocktail. Nobody feels cool saying that, feeling that, doing that, right? And so for us, it's very important that we begin to adapt language like non-alcoholic cocktails, spirit-free cocktails, elixirs, whatever you want to call it, anything but a mocktail, because I do not know a single person who feels cool when the word mocktail leaves their mouth. And a huge part of this segment is legitimizing the space. But a huge part of this push, this mission, this vision is how do we get non-alcoholic cocktails to have a similar foothold to alcoholic cocktails? How do we put them in the same place so that when you're celebrating something, it feels every bit as natural to grab that NA champagne as it does to grab the alcoholic champagne? That we can make more conscious decisions about the role and place of alcohol in our lives. But and there is definitely a time and a place for alcohol. But it is not all the time, you know, and we have been led to believe that it is all the time, that anytime there is something that needs to be celebrated, anytime there is something that needs to be mourned, but alcohol is the thing that we turn to. And this is truly just the product of some of the greatest marketing in human history. And our whole posit is that non-alcoholic has every bit as much to offer as its alcoholic counterparts, and with the added benefit of you don't wake up with a hangover the next day, so you can continue to celebrate on day two.
I wanted to get some practical advice. My home bartending is hybrid. Sometimes I want to drink with alcohol. Sometimes I don't. And it's sometimes challenging for me to make that non-alcoholic one. And I do call it a mocktail at home. I'm okay with it. As good as the other one. Do you have a quick bit of advice for a home experimenter like me? And don't worry, you won't see my resume. You wouldn't hire me as your bartender then.
We have amazing drink makers at the bar. We're incredibly, incredibly fortunate. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I recommend every home drink maker, especially in the non-alcoholic space, start with a non-alcoholic margarita. And this is why. Non-alcoholic tequilas are one of the most photorealistic. So by and large, non-alcoholic tequilas are some of the spirits that do the best job of conveying their alcoholic counterparts. Two is that most NA spirits, many, many, many on the market, and now we're getting a touch more sophisticated with modern technologies and new methodologies, but most NA spirits will use capsaicin as a way to replicate the burn of ethanol. This is a bad analog, but it's what many people have turned to. And so you get a little bit of spice, a little bit of burn, that kind of feeling of having a hot pepper when you use some of these non-alcoholic substitutes. And this plays very well with the profile of a margarita. It is also quite a simple cocktail to build, right? So I like using Dose. It's a non-alcoholic orange liqueur as my orange liqueur. Ritual Tequila, which can be found just about anywhere, is an excellent tequila for this use case. And you can build an excellent little non-alcoholic margarita at home. From there, you can start to experiment and explore your preferences, right? So you may make your non-alcoholic margarita at a 2 ounces non-alcoholic tequila, 1/2 ounce non-alcoholic Dose, 1/2 ounce agave, 1 ounce lime, and a pinch of salt. But that's a great build for us. But you may make that and say, drink's a little bit sweet, right? So you can drop your agave by a 1/4 ounce, or you can drop your Dose by a 1/4 ounce. And you can start to very, very simply in this category, explore and play around with balance, right? How does NA affect the balance of the drink? And what balance do you enjoy? So the margarita is an amazing place to start to have an understanding of your preferences, of your profile, of the way that you like to manipulate non-alcoholic ingredients.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
And that is Ryan Castellaz, founder and service partner of Agency, a hybrid cocktail lounge in Milwaukee. Spoke with Rob Ferret about the art of making non-alcoholic cocktails and the growing market for NA beverages in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is experiencing a snowy January with more than 13 inches accumulated so far. Spots like Rhinelander in the North Woods have about 17 inches on the ground. You go. And there could be more on the way alongside those dangerously cold wind chills. And we want to know, how does the snowpack change this month for you? Maybe you're a big cross-country skier or snowshoer. Have you been getting out more to enjoy those activities? And perhaps you're a snowplow driver or run a snow removal business. How is business going for you? Are you busy? Check in with us on the snowfall, and you could hear your comments in a future program. Email wisconsintoday at wpr.org or call or text to reach us. That number is 888-642-0232. Again, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.